Good morning. Democrats will get a vote this week on their plan to extend health insurance subsidies. Republicans have their own plan. Neither are expected to pass. So what are millions of Americans planning to do? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Kremlin is cheering a new White House national security memo. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The security plan suggested the U.S. would support far-right parties in Europe and that immigration would erase European civilization. Also, why does a streaming service, Netflix, want to buy one of Hollywood's oldest studios, Warner Brothers? One analyst says Netflix is already acting like a traditional studio. It's Monday, December 8th. On this day in 2012, Texas A&M quarterback Johnny Manziel became the first freshman to win the Heisman Trophy. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case that could upend the balance of powers in the federal government. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, the Trump administration has asked the high court to overturn a 90-year precedent.
In 1935, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Congress could put limits on the president's power to fire heads of some independent agencies. The agency in question was the Federal Trade Commission. Today, the court considers whether those limits are constitutional. The new case started with Trump's removal of FTC Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter in March. She was told her service was inconsistent with the administration's priorities. Slaughter sued, calling her firing illegal, and a lower court agreed with her, citing the 1935 case. The Trump administration says that ruling was flawed and should be overturned. They argue the Constitution puts the president in charge of the entire executive branch and Congress cannot siphon that power away from him. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky goes to London today. He'll meet the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany to talk about ongoing negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. Rebecca Rossman reports.
Talks at 10 Downing Street are being billed as another show of support from Ukraine's European allies. Zelensky, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, French President Emmanuel Macron, and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz will continue working on amendments to a peace plan drafted by the U.S. and Russia. The initial draft drew criticism for offering Ukraine too few security guarantees and giving Russia wide authority over Ukraine's military and political future. Ukraine submitted revisions last month, but negotiations are ongoing. The meeting comes as Russia continues drone and missile attacks, launching hundreds of drones and dozens of missiles at Ukraine over the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Rebecca Rossman in London.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he wants to talk about the next phase of President Trump's Gaza peace plan when the Israeli leader arrives in Washington.
No opportunities for peace are there. We tend to exploit them. I'm going to discuss them with President Trump when I meet him later on this month.
One of the conditions for peace includes Hamas disarming itself. A senior Hamas official has told NPR that it's willing to store its weapons and guarantee they won't be used against Israel. But the Hamas official says that will only happen as long as there are political talks to create a Palestinian state. Netanyahu opposes a Palestinian state. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has not released video of a second U.S. military strike on a boat in the Caribbean that killed two survivors. He says his agency is reviewing it. President Trump says he's willing to release it. Some Democratic and Republican lawmakers say the video can be published. You're listening to NPR News. Forecasters say a significant storm is speeding into the Pacific Northwest. Extremely heavy rain is coming, and the National Weather Service has issued flood watches and cautions about wind in Oregon and Washington state. Wind warnings stretch well into the Dakotas. In Southern California, thousands of people gathered over the weekend. They watched one of the oldest outdoor holiday tree lighting displays in the U.S. Many thought it wouldn't happen after the deadly L.A. fires nearly a year ago. From Altadena, California, Stephen Cuevas has more.
For over a century, the dozens of 100-foot-tall cedar trees lining Santa Rosa Avenue in Altadena come alive each December with a colorful galaxy of lights. It was feared the mile-long stretch of cedars would have been lost in the Eaton Fire. They survived, shielding scores of homes below their branches. Altadena's representative in Congress, Judy Chu, called Saturday night's celebration a moment of healing and triumph.
We know how much the Eaton Fire devastated our community, taking 19 precious lives, destroying so many homes. But you showed us what resilience looks like.
Altadena's Christmas tree lane will shine brightly every night through the new year. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Altadena.
A new NASA study says there are so many satellites in orbit they could ruin the pictures taken by space-based telescopes. Photos taken by the Hubble telescope could show streaks in them. NASA says 500,000 satellites could be in orbit in 10 years. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
December 8th, 1980. John Wiener got the news like most everyone did. On TV.
Murder of John Lennon.
John Lennon, former Beatles member, was dead, shot by a crazed fan outside his home in New York. Wiener wanted to do something. What he decided to do was to write a book about Lennon. In 1964, Wiener, a St. Paul native, was 2 years out of high school when the Beatles made their historic appearance on Ed Sullivan. From that moment on, he loved the Mop Tops. But the Lennon he wanted to write about in his book was the post-Beatles Lennon, the anti-war protester and the Richard Nixon critic. But when Wiener went to get a copy of the FBI's Lennon files, he was denied. He had to go to court to get them released. And they revealed that the FBI and Nixon had colluded to deport John Lennon because they were afraid he'd influence the upcoming presidential election. Nixon was reelected but resigned after Watergate. Lennon got to stay in the United States, and John Wiener put the entire story in his 2000 book, Gimme Some Truth.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The enhanced healthcare subsidies that were created during the COVID pandemic will expire at the end of the month unless Congress acts quickly.
California Republican Kevin Kiley says it's time for both parties to work together to avoid major spikes in premiums.
There is perhaps no single question that has greater stakes for affordability in America in the coming year than doing something about the expiration of these tax credits.
Hear from people across the country who are facing higher insurance costs next month on the tough decisions that they're facing. And we'll look at the data on who is expected to have to pay the most. But we start with what the parties in Congress have done in the past few weeks to address those expiring subsidies. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh has been watching. So Deirdre, as part of the deal to end the shutdown last month, Democrats were promised a Senate vote on health care. What will they be presenting?
Well, there is no bipartisan deal. So Democrats rolled out their own plan last week, which is a 3-year extension of the existing tax credits. And there's going to be a vote on Thursday on that. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says all Democrats are going to vote for that. He says Republicans can't agree on any plan of their own. And the only option on the table right now is to pass this straight extension.
Democrats are fighting to lower health care costs. Republicans are fighting with one another.
But the Democrats' plan is not expected to get the 60 votes needed to advance in the Senate.
Okay, so what do Senate Republicans want?
Well, they're split. Some Republicans do back extending the subsidies. You know, 24 million people currently rely on them. But GOP lawmakers say there needs to be some kind of income caps to limit who gets these subsidies and some reforms. Senate Majority Leader John Thune dismissed the 3-year extension that Democrats are proposing. He says it's not a serious proposal. Louisiana Republican Bill Cassidy is pushing Thune and Republican leaders to allow a vote on his proposal. That would redirect money the government spends to subsidize ACA plans and instead give them directly to consumers and set up health care savings accounts. Cassidy talked about this on Fox News Sunday.
We want to give an additional choice, one in which your premium is lower and that you have money in an account to help pay for it.
So Thune hasn't decided if the Republicans are even going to put up an alternative for a vote. Even if Republicans do move forward with something like Cassidy's plan, that doesn't have the votes to advance in the Senate either. You know, these are shaping up to be messaging votes. Right now, there's not an effort to get agreement on something that can actually become law.
Okay, so what about the House?
Well, House Speaker Mike Johnson is planning to release a health care bill this week. He's promising a vote this month, but we don't have any details on what's going to be in it, and he's not negotiating with any Democrats. Like Senate Republicans, House Republicans are also divided. Some like the health savings account approach Cassidy's talking about, but there are other House Republicans from swing districts who are teaming up with Democrats to push bills. They call for 1 or 2 year extensions of these subsidies with some reforms.
All right, so we've talked about the Senate and the House. What about the White House? Where is the president on this debate?
Well, the president has mostly been on the sidelines. You know, some Republicans from competitive districts I talked to last week say they've reached out to him and the White House to talk about the policy and the politics about the need to extend these subsidies in some form. But President Trump has not endorsed any legislation. Members of both parties agree on one thing. If Trump doesn't get involved to negotiate some kind of deal soon, these major increases in healthcare premiums are going to happen in January, and they will definitely be a major issue in the 2026 midterms.
That's NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Hopefully those are not wolves at your door, Deirdre, just dogs. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
NPR has been speaking with people who expect to pay more for health insurance if Congress can't come to an agreement on subsidies this month.
Yeah, back in November, we spoke to Chris O'Donnell. He lives in Virginia, and at the time, he said he was expecting his family to pay an additional $1,300 a month for health care in the year ahead. Late last week, we checked back in with him, and he wasn't hopeful.
I will be pleasantly surprised if Congress does anything to help. I'm not expecting it. Moving forward with the assumption that my premiums next year are going to be $21.55 a month.
So he's been looking at the money he has and...
I can pay it barely. I basically have to redirect all this money I was planning on putting towards retirement or savings in general towards healthcare premiums. But according to the spreadsheet that I built with all my finances, we'll scrape by.
Hannah Panuski lives in Georgia. She got married this year.
We had thoughts in mind for next year to like buy a house, start a family. And now with the subsidies going away and our insurance practically doubling, we're just really questioning what exactly we can afford.
She says she can't go without insurance, so she expects to get another plan through the federal marketplace, even if subsidies go away.
It doesn't make sense for us to not have health insurance at all, and it does feel like the only option, unfortunately.
Eric Krause in New Jersey tells us he might just go without coverage. He says his wife just got a new job with health care, but he doesn't know if it'll be any cheaper than an ACA plan. If they do the math and find they can't afford it,
then I will forego health insurance for the year.
Krause says he has a marketplace plan now, and it's already too expensive.
I just had a child, and maybe having that child, if I had to pay the full $40,000 of the hospital bill, would I see maybe a couple thousand dollars in benefit from having health insurance, which is ridiculous.
If the subsidies go away, Krause expects that the people who will keep their policies will be older, sicker Americans who have no choice.
You're going to lose all of these people who are healthy, who are young, and the system seems to depend on that. So I don't think that the Republicans are even considering that.
Those voices are just some of the millions of Americans who are expected to pay more for health care premiums if Congress doesn't pass a bill this month. The average premium will more than double, according to KFF Health News, the nonpartisan health policy organization which ran the numbers. Gerard Anderson has been sizing up who is likely to pay the most. He's a professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. So, Professor, who is in for the sharpest increase if Congress can't come to an agreement?
So anyone who makes about $50,000 to $200,000 a year is going to have the greatest increases in their premiums, simply because the subsidies that were additional subsidies that were put in really benefited that population the greatest.
All right. Now, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of people. What is driving those differences? Is it where people live, how old they are, or something else?
It is all of the above. Everybody is unique. It depends on how sick you are, what plan you are, what are the other plans in the area, whether or not you originally had a more expensive plan and now can go down to a less plan. So everyone is going to have a very different experience. The typical person will end up paying about twice as much in a premium, but that's just the average person. Everyone will have it uniquely affect them.
Professor, this net is starting to sound very, very wide in terms of who's going to be affected a lot by this.
Yeah, it's going to be about 4 million people that are going to lose coverage. There'll be another 10 million people that'll probably have less coverage, but all of us will in fact be affected, because what'll happen is the doctors in the hospitals will all of a sudden see more patients that can't pay, and when that happens, they'll need to raise their rates. And when the rates get increased by the hospitals and physicians, insurance premiums for everybody who has private insurance will increase. So that's 150 million people. So it's not just the 4 million that are going to lose coverage, the 10 million that will have less coverage, but it's all people who have private insurance are going to be affected. Maybe not immediately, but certainly within a year.
Now, we just heard from some people on these marketplace plans a few minutes ago that someone said that they would have to make the budget work somehow. One said that he might skip insurance altogether. Do you expect many people will drop health care, just completely say no more health care for me, at least for now, if they lose subsidies?
I think you will expect about 4 million, and it's hard to say exactly how many and exactly who will make that decision. But those people tend to be a little bit healthier. If you have cancer, if you have had a heart attack, if you've had any serious illness, you're going to be very reluctant to drop your health insurance coverage. However, if you're basically healthy and maybe have one or two things wrong with you, you might say, I just don't have the money. And the problem with that is the people that remain in the plans are going to be sicker and sicker, and so the premiums will increase. So the premiums themselves are going to increase maybe 26% this year, simply because the insurers believe that the sick people will remain with coverage and the healthy people will drop coverage.
Let's hear from a Republican with an alternative. Here's Senator Bill Cassidy on Fox News Sunday.
So if we do continue the subsidies, you can put that over here, 100% going to the patient, and put it into a health savings account. They get a cheaper premium, and they get first dollar coverage. They have money in their account to pay for their daughter's sprained ankle.
All right, so what about that? Health savings accounts instead. How helpful could they be?
They would be great for the sprained ankle. If it's a small amount, it will be just fine to have a health savings account. However, if you have a serious illness, if you go to the hospital, the health savings account, which maybe will give you $3,000 or $4,000, will pay less than 1/10 of the cost of the hospitalization. So they're going to be absolutely no help at all.
Just a few seconds left. I mean, do you think there will ever be a U.S. healthcare system that both parties can agree on and say, this is it, this is what we got in the U.S.?
So I'm hoping that's the case, but I'm not optimistic. The real difference between the two sides is what I call the 20-80 rule. 20% of us incur 80% of the spending, and the Republicans are concerned about the 80% that are not sick, the 20% that are sick.
Gerald Anderson is a professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins. Thank you.
Thank you.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station, an extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
PR comes from the station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Linley and a new season of Karen Peary, streaming at BritBox.com. From the University of Maryland Libraries, home to the NPR Archives, dedicated to preserving the history of public broadcasting and serving researchers around the world. More at lib.umd.edu. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. President Trump says he will be, quote, involved in whether or not federal regulators approve Netflix's plan to buy Warner Brothers Discovery. Netflix announced the $83 billion deal on Friday, which would reshape the entertainment business if it's approved. To break it all down, we're joined by Matt Bellany, founding partner of news site Puck and author of Puck's What I'm Hearing newsletter. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, why does Netflix want Warner Brothers?
First, it's a treasure trove of intellectual property. Mm-hmm. Franchises like Batman, Superman, Game of Thrones. I mean, just unbelievable things that Netflix has not been able to create on its own. It does have its own franchises, but it's only been making original movies and TV for about a decade. And then on the streaming side, it would give them the HBO Max streaming service, which has about 130 million subscribers worldwide. So it's a really valuable entity for multiple reasons for Netflix.
Now, there's already been a lot of pushback on this merger from screenwriters to the administration. What's the biggest concern?
Everybody in Hollywood is always wanting more buyers for original film and TV. And if Warner Brothers is sold to Netflix, those are the, you know, two of the bigger buyers in town. And the fear is that it would cause one of them to either go away completely or be severely diminished. But I think on the regulatory side, it really is a question of whether this gives Netflix too much power and how you define the market for what Netflix does. Are they a TV platform? Are they a streamer? Are they a general entertainment company? Are they competing with the Hollywood studios? Are they competing with TikTok? Are they competing with YouTube? So it's a real question of kind of the future of entertainment and whether it's going to be consolidated around a few gigantic companies.
Now, Warner Brothers was already going to spin off a bunch of its cable channels, CNN or Discovery. Netflix won't be buying them. And Warner Brothers just bought Discovery a few years ago. I mean, what does this mean for that larger package?
Yeah, the cable channels are being spun off into a new entity that's mm-hmm. going to be called Discovery Global. And they could potentially sell off individual networks. So someone comes along and says, I really want to own CNN. They would be willing to do a deal there. It's really a mechanism to take those very profitable yet declining businesses and take them away from the growth businesses, which are streaming and the studio. Netflix was not interested in cable channels. It doesn't want to own CNN. It doesn't want to own linear cable channels. So now they're separating them so that Netflix will have something pure to buy.
You pose this question in your newsletter. Is this deal, quote, definitively the end of Hollywood as we know it? I mean, what's the answer to that question?
I think the answer is that Hollywood is an evolving concept. And to say that the end of Hollywood is near is a little bit misguided, I think. It just lacks nuance because Hollywood is changing. I mean, Netflix operates so much more like a traditional Hollywood studio than most people realize. Yes, it's a streaming company, and yes, it operates digitally and has done a lot of things differently, but at its core, it is working with traditional filmmakers, television showrunners, writers, directors, and that is just the modern incarnation of a studio. And I think it's just hard for people in Hollywood to put their heads around that because they're known as this disruptor and they are the evil empire coming in from Silicon Valley and reshaping the way business is done. And a lot of that is true. But I think it's living in the past for people to think that this traditional Hollywood system was going to go on forever and just kind of ignore the internet.
Is more and more of what we consume, where you can go to make creative things, just now being put into one hand?
Yes. We saw this happen when most of Fox was sold to Disney. That took the Hollywood studio system from 6 down to 5. This would take it from 5 down to 4. And there would only be 4 legacy Hollywood studios remaining. Now, what that fails to account for is that there are 3 major players now in Hollywood that are just not traditional studios. There's Netflix, there's Amazon Prime Video, and there's Apple TV. All 3 of those are major buyers and major providers of entertainment. They're just not considered traditional Hollywood studios.
That's Puck founding partner Matt Bellany. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
A group of soldiers declared a military coup in the tiny West African country of Benin on Sunday. But almost as soon as it began, the government announced it had regained control. It's the latest in a wave of attempted coups in the region, as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports.
The opening scenes from an all too familiar script in West Africa.
The Beninois. Chers compatriotes.
On Sunday morning, gunshots were reported in the capital, Porto-Novo, shortly before soldiers took over the state broadcaster in Benin and gave a live address.
Avons décidé de prendre nos responsabilités suite aux multiples dérives.
They announced they had deposed President Patrice Talon and taken over the country, blaming corruption, growing insecurity near the northern border with West Africa's Sahel, and political repression. But the apparent coup was short-lived. Within a few hours, Benin's interior minister announced they had foiled the attempt. 14 soldiers were arrested, the government said. Airstrikes, apparently targeting the coup plotters, were later heard in the commercial capital, Cotonou, launched by Air Force jets sent from neighboring Nigeria.
À ces aventuriers et d'éviter le pire à notre pays.
Finally, on Sunday evening, President Talon addressed the country. He said the coup attempt had been foiled just over a year after a previous effort, and he said calm and normalcy had been restored. But there remain many unanswered questions on the true extent of the coup and its potential ripple effects. Talon has been in power since 2016 and was due to step down next April. The former businessman has faced accusations of authoritarianism in the tiny coastal nation that is fast developing and is largely viewed as more stable than many of its neighbors. But after several coups and attempted takeovers in West and Central Africa, the entire region is at alert. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
This is NPR News.
Scientists have discovered millions of new species on Earth since the 1700s, and we are averaging 17,000 more every year. But how many more are there?
The range of estimates of how many species are out there are from the low millions to the low trillions.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The mission to better understand life on our own planet, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXC. Andrew DeZingle will be your local host. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 529. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. Coming up in just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for the state, December 8th. We do have a chance of snow this afternoon. Cloudy today with highs in the upper teens. Winds from the south gusting up to 15 miles per hour. Chance of snow before midnight. Cloudy. Lows in the single digits above. And for tomorrow, chance of snow once again in the afternoon. Cloudy. Highs in the low 20s. Area book lovers are invited to a book swap at the KBXE studio in Bemidji this Wednesday. You can bring some books, take some books, 5:30 to 7:30. You can also talk about your favorite books with fellow readers, staff, and What We're Reading host, Tammy Bobrowski. There will be used books from the Red Door Bookstore available for purchase. Lights in the Pines is a drive-through holiday light display at the Itasca County Fairgrounds in Grand Rapids. Hours are 5 to 8 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays now until Christmas. After seeing the lights, you may park and explore North Pole Junction inside the fair's commercial building. And United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. Central Lakes College invites you to their Holly Jolly Concert and Tuba Christmas. That's this Wednesday, 7 o'clock, in the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. Let us know what's happening in your community. Email us, psa@kaxe.org.
On today's date, December 8th, 2008, the American bittersweet reveals its presence by being one of the few colorful objects still up in the trees. The American bittersweet is bright red. The berry is bright red. It has these two half sheaths that open up that are orange in color. So you've got this bright red berry and these bright orange sheaths that sort of cup it. And they all stem from a vine that climbs anti-clockwise up some plant nearby, whether it's the branches and limbs and trunk of an aspen or the climbing up of a speckled alder. Sometimes it will even climb up into balsam or spruce. But it is very revealing this time of year to see those bright orange and bright red berries as that plant climbs. It's important to note that there are two plants in this group. There is a female, which has the berries, and there's a male somewhere nearby that has no berries whatsoever and is only just a vine at this point and would be a little difficult to recognize. So when you find the one, look for the plant without the berries, the male.
Shing's head.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
For more on how U.S. relations with Europe are changing in real time, we turn to Alexandra DeHoop-Scheffer to discuss this new national security memo from the Trump administration. She's president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a nonpartisan policy organization that works to advance U.S.-European cooperation. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So this new national security memo says the U.S. should cultivate, quote, resistance to Europe's current trajectory and should stop NATO from perpetually expanding. When you hear that, resist this current trajectory, stop NATO from expanding, what do you think?
Well, I think we are entering an era of strategic reinvention for the transatlantic relationship, which means that Europe is understanding that this is going to be a very different phase in its relationship with the United States. And one thing that struck me truly is that Europe is not able to put the snooze button anymore on many issues where it has paused because the United States has always been there. And so what we are gathering across our European office network from Germany, France, Brussels, Warsaw, London, is a realization that Europe will have to take its responsibilities, and mostly its responsibilities in Europe and defense, with less America. And the engagement of the United States with and in Europe will be much more selective. In addition to that, mm-hmm. you just mentioned an unprecedented language, right, for a strategic document addressing European allies. So yes, what you're seeing is probably an increasing gap when it comes to values, when it comes to norms. However, there is a non-negotiable requirement for Europe and the United States to redefine their relationship, their cooperation, probably much more in terms of shared interests than shared values.
So you're saying the U.S. and Europe no longer share the same values?
I think this is going to be a huge shift mm-hmm. in the transatlantic relationship. However, this does not impede the possibility or the imperative for the U.S. and Europe to continue to cooperate. And the number one urgent issue, obviously, is Ukraine. And this is where Europe concretely has been stepping up, and stepping up in a significant way, because it just doesn't have the choice.
What should Europe do in this moment? This document is out. It really shows that the administration views its relationship with foreign powers really not as a source of freedom in the world, as the U.S. has often seen itself, but a place to reduce migration in the West and to have transactional and financially lucrative relationships. So how should Europe respond in this moment?
Well, Europe needs to do three things simultaneously. One is continue to partner with the United States when interests align. And there are still many core issues where the U.S. and Europe needs and are actually actively cooperating, like uh-huh. the resilience of supply chains, the strategy towards China, all of these in defense industrial cooperation, all of these issues that keep the U.S. and Europe together. Number two, Europe will have to go it alone when interests diverge. And one of these key issues is obviously climate, but also a certain set of values, as you've just mentioned. And then number three, Europe will have to build alliances with other like-minded powers. And that's particularly true. You've seen it over the past months with Indo-Pacific countries, but also mm-hmm. Middle Eastern countries and Latin American countries. So I would say what you are seeing live today is a new transatlantic bargain where Europeans are accepting and integrating the idea that the transatlantic relationship is going to be more transactional, more conditional, and that includes collective defense, but also more issue by issue. And so this is the time for Europe to step up, to reduce its strategic dependencies vis-a-vis the United States, while at the same time preserving the transatlantic link. So it's about preserving, but yet preparing for what comes next.
What are the implications for the U.S. as it shifts its strategy and other places change their view of the U.S. and their relationship with the U.S.?
Well, I think for the United States, what you are seeing is, you know, you mentioned this national security strategy document. It actually clarifies, it makes explicit what has been implicit for years, which is that the U.S. is reordering its global priorities around its core interests and not historical relationships. And you see it with the ranking, right? It's the Western Hemisphere first, it's China second, and then it's Europe third. And by Europe, I mean it's going to be a much more selective engagement. And we're moving away from burden sharing to burden shifting. And so from a U.S. perspective, the expectations towards Europeans in terms of taking more responsibility for their own security, their own defense, is going to be on the top of the U.S. transatlantic agenda.
And you mentioned the war in Ukraine. What could this all mean for that?
Yes. Well, I think on Ukraine, what you're seeing is Washington on the one side wanting speed. Europe on the other side needs stability and needs long-term security stability and needs to avoid a frozen conflict on its doorstep. At the end of the day, this so-called peace plan is actually going to define the terms of the future NATO-EU-Russia relationship. And so, yes, everyone wants to have a peace deal, but you need to have a good peace deal. But at the end of the day, this is going to be Trump's peace deal. He's going to own this peace deal. And so what Europeans want to do is co-offer this peace deal to be sure that it's going to be a sustainable one, both for Ukraine.
Yes, thank you. We'll have to leave it there. Alexandra de Hoop Scheffer is president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Hey, it's News Director Chelsea Perkins from KAXE, and we are celebrating. Because of you, we blew our Give to the Max Day fundraising goal out of the water. Your support does more than keep the lights on. It powers trusted local journalism rooted right here in northern Minnesota. It helps our news desk tell the stories that matter, ask the questions that need to be asked, and amplify voices you don't hear anywhere else. Every dollar that you gave has quadrupled the power thanks to our participation in the National Newsmatch program through the Institute of Nonprofit News. This is an investment in people-powered news, community connection, and the future of public media. There's still time to support KAXE this year. You can make a year-end gift anytime through December 31st at KAXE.org. From all of us at KAXE, thank you for believing in local news. And thank you for making this work possible.
It is 5:43. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. We do have a chance of snow this afternoon. Cloudy today, highs in the upper teens. Winds from the south gusting up to 15 miles per hour. Chance of snow continues before midnight. Cloudy, lows near 8. And for Tuesday, once again, chance of snow in the afternoon with cloudy skies and highs in the low 20s. Bringing light to Chisholm is this Thursday, December 11th from 5 to 7 on Lake Street in downtown Chisholm. Enjoy hot cocoa, bonfires, caroling, sleigh rides, Santa, and more. And the classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork on Thursday at 6:30. This month's film is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner from 1967, starring Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, and Sidney Poitier. Coming up just after 7, the Up North Report. Right now, we continue with Morning Edition on KAXE.
Good
Good morning, me, Martinez. A 5-year-old black Labrador mix named Sadie was with her owners on vacation in San Diego. They were staying near the beach when she ran out to the water and a riptide swept her into the ocean. Two lifeguards went out on a jet ski and searched for an hour. Just as they were about to call it off, they saw Sadie in the distance, 3/4 of a mile from shore. Hey, sometimes retrievers need to be retrieved. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters this Friday. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Martinez. Late fall and early winter is deer hunting season in many parts of the U.S. Most hunters headed into the field will be armed with bullets made of lead, which is toxic for predators that eat animals shot by hunters and left behind. As Maine Public's Peter McGuire reports, some hunters are now pushing to ditch lead bullets for good. And a warning, this story includes the sound of gunfire.
At Avian Haven in Freedom, Maine, it's feeding time at the bald eagle enclosure. Executive Director Barbara Haney says that out of the 36 eagles brought into the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center last year, 75% had lead poisoning.
That's a lot. That actually corresponds with the statistics that we're getting from other rehab centers as well.
Sick birds are so weak that they can't hold their heads or wings up. They're confused and unfocused. Some live, but others are too far gone. And Haney says hundreds of lead fragments left in animal remains after they're hit with a bullet is the only source of that contamination. She says a lead fragment the size of a grain of rice is enough to kill an eagle.
If we can do a simple thing like cut back on the amount of lead that's in the environment, it's going to make a huge impact on our wildlife.
Decades after the U.S. banned lead in gasoline, paint, and water pipes, lead hunting bullets are still very common. But Brian Bedrosian thinks it doesn't have to be that way. He's a Wyoming hunter and founder of Sporting Lead Free, a group that has ambassadors across the country persuading hunters to pick solid copper bullets instead. Copper bullets don't fragment when they hit an animal.
Hunters are the original conservationists. This should be something that we should all try and get behind.
Bedrosian says the effort could take a couple generations, but momentum is growing. He says copper bullets used to be uncommon, but are getting cheaper and more available all the time, even though lead bullets still cost less. And most hunters care about wildlife and the environment. That's why Bedrosian says persuasion is more effective than government bans on lead ammo.
If you encourage and inform people why they need to make the choice, you're going to be much more successful than trying to force them to make an action where they don't understand the why.
All right, I'm going hot.
Yeah, going hot.
At a gun range in Scarborough, Maine, Tim Summers peers through the scope of his deer rifle and gets ready to squeeze off a shot to sight in the gun.
It's on the target that would have killed deer.
Summers says he's never tried copper bullets, but he eats the meat from the animals he kills, so he's willing to give non-lead ammo a try.
You think about it, it's a little pellet at the end of the day of lead. You know, if that shatters and gets into the meat and stuff of an animal, then, you know, you could be ingesting quite a bit of it, I guess.
Charlie Largay is the supervisor at the range. He's been a hunter and a competitive shooter most of his life. These days, Largay only uses copper bullets.
It's just as accurate, if not more so. And it doesn't leave the residue behind. I mean, we don't need the woods full of lead.
There's precedent for this kind of phase-out. It's against federal law to hunt ducks and geese with lead shot. And Largay says lead ammo is still fine to use for target shooting.
Typically, if you're a deer hunter or you're hunting most game, you're going to get one shot.
And Largay says there's no need for that bullet to contain lead. For NPR News, I'm Peter McGuire in Scarborough, Maine.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this green cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
Can AI do better than slippers or a necktie?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, invoicing, and more to help entrepreneurs manage their finances. Learn more at mercury.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, the Supreme Court is set to hear arguments today in Trump versus Slaughter, a case that has broad implications for consumers and workers. Does a president have the power to fire the leaders of independent federal agencies? In this case, the Federal Trade Commission. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
The case involves President Trump's firing of Rebecca Slaughter. She was a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC was created in 1914 as part of congressional trust busting. Since then, the agency has brought a number of antitrust cases, including against big tech companies like Meta. The FTC's mission is to protect consumers from monopolies and deceptive practices. The heads of agencies like the FTC are meant to be insulated from politics. This case could affect top officials at other agencies meant to protect consumers and workers, such as the Consumer Product Safety Commission, Merit Systems Protection Board, and National Labor Relations Board. The court will consider another case along these lines next month, President Trump's attempt to fire Lisa Cook, a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. It's not clear whether the Supreme Court will give the Fed a carve-out protecting its independence. The law only allows a president to fire a Fed board member for cause. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Like the hovering salesperson who insists on offering you help, there may be artificial intelligence breathing down your neck as you shop, or maybe you're asking for a little help from AI. So far this season of consumption, traffic to retail sites pushed along by AI is up nearly eightfold from last year, according to Adobe Analytics. For instance, Walmart has an AI shopping assistant called Sparky. Amazon has Rufus. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
Luca Sion was fresh out of gift ideas for a friend who's into dressing up, so he turned to an AI chatbot, which recommended an appointment with a fashion consultant.
Something that honestly didn't know existed, and so I thought it was a cool idea.
Sion, a marketing professor at the University of Virginia, says shoppers also use AI to compare the features and prices of products like TVs and vacuum cleaners.
There are so many products, and we have so many choices. And so instead of me spending hours reading through a lot of websites, I have someone or something better reading.
Where AI falls short is the subjective stuff. Picking out a sweater requires a sense of personal aesthetics. Aaron Cheris, who leads the global retail practice at Bain, says it also has a tough time with intricate orders, but imagines a future where you could give a chatbot your grocery list.
40 items from this retailer, 20 items from this retailer, and 15 from this retailer, and I'll save you $10.
Cherish says that will require consumers' trust. For instance, what if chatbots start partnering with brands for product placement?
Do I still trust that when I asked it to get me the best deal on everything, it's really getting me the best deal?
It'll be up to shoppers to decide. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I just asked the Amazon shopping AI what I should get for myself, and it suggested a deck of 52 cards, each with a workout exercise. What exactly are you trying to tell me, Mr. Rufus AI? Markets, S&P futures are up less than 0.1% now. NASDAQ futures up 0.2%. And life is pretty good if you're the CEO of the largest of banks. The economic assessment from Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase this weekend was, quote, in the short run, it looks like the American consumer is doing fine, is chugging along. Companies are making profits. Stock markets are high, Dimon told Fox News. Quoting again, there are little small negatives. Jobs are weakening, but just a bit. Inflation is there and maybe not going down.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
Now to finding work after rehab. It can be an uphill climb, sometimes with gaps in employment history or debt. In the woods and lakes of northern Michigan, there are a number of rehab centers generating thousands of alumni a year, and at least one employer is making a point to hire them. It's a wood manufacturing company with a labor shortage. Claire Keenan-Kurgan of Interlochen Public Radio has this story of not a halfway, but a three-quarters house where staff in recovery share a home together.
Inside this wood factory in Petoskey, Michigan, Stephanie Costi looks at the list of work orders for her day producing wood veneers. The veneer she's working on could become a guitar.
It becomes doors. Oh my goodness. It's a whole list. It makes a lot of stuff.
She's been at this job for about a year and a half. She found it after leaving rehab here in Petoskey.
I was addicted to heroin and meth for about 10 years. I lost my kids. I lost my house. I lost everything.
That all happened in her old town, Battle Creek, Michigan. After coming up here for rehab in northern Michigan, she didn't want to go back. This job at the wood plant, it allowed her to stay. She works for Abe Monti, one of the owners of the company here. He says they realized they needed more staff during COVID, when orders for new kitchen cabinets were pouring in. So they started posting flyers in the rehab centers in town.
People are coming from other places to those inpatient centers, and they don't want to go back home, you know, because they want to restart their life.
People were taking the jobs, but they needed housing and sometimes help staying sober. They decided to take a renovated motel that they already used for employee housing and make it a sober house. There's a recovery coach on site.
Not just substance use coaching, it's life skill coaching. So it's get your driver's license back. It's help save money for a car.
Peggy Swarbrick, a professor at Rutgers University who studies addiction recovery, says that for people re-entering life sober,
employment, having a purposeful, meaningful structure to your day is essential.
Monti thinks other companies, especially in rural areas with rehab centers, could make this work too, if they have the right recovery coach to guide people. Stephanie Costi, the one working at the plant, is starting to rebuild her life. She just moved into her own house. She has hobbies for the first time in her adult life.
I'm coming up on 2 years clean in February, and I'm still trying to piece together who I am.
And who she wants to be. Eventually, her goal is to become a recovery coach herself. In Petoskey, Michigan, I'm Claire Keenan-Kurgan for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 in the Brainerd area, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. Lots of local news stories and conversations there, and you can click the donate button to become a member. Thanks so much for your support. I'm Jen. Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition and coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News. 7:45 this morning, we are going to have a bright spot with GRIMBA. That's the Grand Rapids Itasca Mountain Bike Association. Cloudy today. We do have a chance of snow this afternoon. Highs in the upper teens. Winds from the south up to 15 miles per hour. Chance of snow before midnight. Cloudy tonight. Lows in the